Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Angela Cerbi. I am in Torino and I am live with Los Angeles with Phil Tippett. We are here to have this talk because you were one of the hosts of the, one of the participants of the View Festival in Torino, which was a festival about visual effects and special effects for films. And you are a very important person to talk about on this subject because you made one of the milestones of the modern visual effects, because you, starting from the very beginning of your career, you work with George Lucas, you work on Star Wars. And for people of my generation and younger, Star Wars is like a God-given gift. It's like a Bible that we all know by heart. And I know that everybody knows that you created the Cantina Band and the holographic chess scene of Star Wars. And I would like to start our interview from there. So what was the inspiration and how complicated was it back then to build up so wonderful special effects?
Well, we were just kind of lucky. We had two friends that had gotten hired as cameramen on Star Wars, and it was towards the end of the schedule, and Ken Ralston and Dennis Muren were on the night shift, and I would go out and meet up with them in Van Nuys, and I was living in LA at the time, and have dinner with them and got acquainted with, you know, Joe Johnston and Lauren Peterson and people that were working there at the time. And then we got a call that George Lucas, he was not happy with what he had shot in England for the chess scene. For the Cantina scene. And I don't think Stuart Freeborn had very much money. And so I think what they did was they kind of recycled. They kind of looked like Beatrix Potter costumes. They were like kind of rat people and alligator people and stuff like that. And George shot that, but he really wanted to have the Cantina populated with space aliens. So through Dennis, he got in contact with our buddy Rick Baker. And Rick put together a shop, and George's direction was make as many space aliens as you can in 6 weeks. And that's what we did. So Rick was working on another job, and he hired me and three other of my buddies who were out-of-work stop-motion animators. And we'd all been friends for years. And that's what we did. Rick donated a number of rubber, just pullover masks that he had. And we built on top of those various creatures. And then when that was complete, well, during that period of time, while we were building it, George would come over once a week to check our progress. And one day he saw a stop motion puppet that I had brought in that I had made when I was a teenager. And he got very interested in it. And he goes like, so you guys do stop motion? And we, yep. He said, well, I have a scene that I would like to be stop motion. And he just made that while we were standing there, because that stop motion puppet gave him the idea. So what had happened was Michael Crichton had come out with a movie called Future World. And in it, there was a hologram of a chess set with all live actors. And previously, George was going to just use the people in costumes and masks. Mm-hmm. But then this gave him the idea, and he said, well, can you make 10 stop-motion space creatures in a couple of weeks? And this was right at the end of the schedule. I mean, at the end of the schedule. And so John and I kind of powered out. Oh, and George asked, can I have that green guy that you built when you were a kid in the movie? And I told him, sure. And so John Berg and I built all the creatures. We brought them in a cardboard box. Dennis lit and Ken helped set up the shot. And I think over two or three nights, John and I would animate the cuts. And I remember on the very last night, we had the surrounded by black flats out on a big stage. And ILM was having its rap party. So people were drinking beer and whooping it up, and they were trying to concentrate on these things. But yeah, that was kind of how it went. And then previously, when we wrapped up the fabrication of the Cantina creatures, space aliens, we took everything down to a little insert stage on La Brea Avenue. And Carol Ballard was the cameraman, and George directed. And so George just called in a few people, some of the secretaries from ILM, and those of us, Lane Lisk, and Doug Beswick, and we all dressed up in the costumes that we'd made, and George would direct us, and that's how it all began.
And then after that, you start your own studios, the Tippett Studios in 1984, and then you went on and you created this Go Motion thing. Actually, you were in Torino at the View Festival talking about Go Motion, which is like mixing stop motion with motion control. So how did you come up with this idea, and how does it work actually, really?
Well, when I would go out to visit Dennis for dinner, that's when I became aware of the motion control technology. And it was all very much prototyped. And for a long time, they weren't even sure if it was all going to work. But, you know, I saw the motion control equipment there. And I think, you know, Ken and Dennis and I, stop motion animators since Starovich, have been trying to figure out ways of putting blurs on stop motion puppets, because stop motion is a sequence of individual frames where each of the images is very clear because it's a still image. But if you shoot a moving object, a person or a horse, at 24 frames a second with a 180-degree shutter on a camera, you get this characteristic motion blur. And that was very, very difficult to achieve. And none of the techniques really looked that great. And so they're very rarely used. And, we started thinking. And then when we moved up to San Rafael, the first thing that we did was, we didn't have any stop motion puppets, but I had one of this kind of aquatic creature left over from, Joe Dante's Piranha that I had made, because Joe and producer John Davis were big stop motion fans, and Joe wanted a stop motion shot in this movie. And so I had this character left over, and Ken and I hooked it up to one axis of the motion control track and shot a number of tests in one afternoon and got the test back, and it was like, that's what we're going to do. You know, it's perfect. It was only one axis of movement, but what that did for a running animal, it had, you know, this thing has to scamper across the snow. And so each of the moves you probably have to do is like, you know, 1.5 or 2 inches, because the thing was moving pretty quickly. And to do that stop motion, you would have gotten a lot of kind of chattery artifacts. But with the what I would do is hand animate all of the little backpacks and Luke and, you know, the Tauntaun's head and arms and tail and legs and all that stuff. And then we would have pre-programmed his forward momentum and shot it that way. So we'd shoot one frame of film, and the thing would move a little bit. I'd go in and animate, step back, shoot another frame, it would move, and that's how we did it. And then after that, it was so successful, we went on and developed a much more robust, kind of like a computer-controlled Bunraku puppet, where each of the, on Dragon Slayer, each of the legs and body were on these XYZ stepper motors. Yeah. And so I had to, completely changed how I thought about building a performance, because in stop motion, you're working with an object on a set with lights, and you're kind of sculpting in time. You're actually using the light and space to help you figure out where you want to move, and you move from pose to pose to pose. But since all of the arms and legs and body were attached to these XYZ movers, I had to be able to visualize the entire performance in my mind and then break down in my mind how to translate those. So, you know, the first axis, you know, would be, you know, leg going up, like that. And then I would have figured out how long the leg would be up, and then boom, leg down. And then you go back and you replay that while you're programming the leg kind of going out and coming back. And then so you combine those, and so the leg lifts up, it kind of goes out, it comes down, and then you have that leg on a track. That leg goes back as the body moves forward. So and it's kind of like, you know, relativity. It's just like you press this button and this leg stays in place while the whole thing moves forward, but this leg is actually moving back. And so that's what we did. So it would take me, at that time, the way that they programmed, I programmed the Dragon was how they did the spaceships. Mm-hmm. And they had a, what they call the joystick, and the motions were created using a velocity. And so you twist this dial, and the motion control would go zzz, and if you turned it faster, it would go zzz. And so we had to get some of the first computers, little tiny Macintoshes.
How do your work change in these 30 years, technologically speaking? I mean, how easy technology is helping you to make your fantasies and your ideas come true?
It's just a tool. You know, and some of the tools, yeah, as the technology advanced, gave you opportunities to do things that you couldn't do otherwise, and in some ways were a lot more freeing in terms of how you could put together a performance. With the Go Motion was tied to like all of these rods and stepper motors and all that, were very, very cumbersome, big, heavy unit. But once it was, you know, demonstrated that, you know, they could, Ilon could create a successful-looking living dinosaur, then you don't have a lot of those problems. It's all virtual. And one of the difficulties with the stop motion, if you're doing something running, is you have to attach it to rigs. You have to light those with green screen. You have to do a lot of rotoscoping get rid of the rigs. But in the computer, it's all for free, and you can have a thing jump up in the air, and nothing's holding it up.
So it makes it. Let's say the technology made your work easier and faster. We can say that.
Oh, it was terrible, because it was all new. I mean, every time you change, you know, from stop motion to go motion, from go motion to computer graphics, you're learning new tools. And every movie when you start on it is different. And so everything you do is a prototype. So you kind of have to find your way. I mean, you come up with a plan, but then along the way you realize, this wasn't completely thought through. And so you find other, you know, avenues just to make the thing work. And to me, it's kind of like being a blacksmith. You know, you just bang on stuff until you know, working right. And I don't, you know, I never touched the computer then at all. It was just, I had no interest in it. I, you know, the thought of sitting at a desk and working was terrible to me. But by that time, I'd kind of been kicked upstairs to do supervising work, because all the animators at ILM had were mostly Canadians, because they didn't teach computer graphics in the United States. So they would hire Canadian students, and they came down. And the experience that they had was mostly, you know, with the kind of Disney school of animation, squash and stretch and flying logos and that kind of thing. So they had no experience with doing living and breathing creatures, which is a whole different kind of a deal. And I knew stuff that that Stephen and Kathy Kennedy wanted because, yeah, I was kind of an amateur paleontologist and I knew all of this stuff. You know, I'd been studying it since I was like 5 years old. And and then I also knew the production process, you know, how you do pre-production and what you need to do when you go out and shoot on location and then coming back, the kind of thing you do in production to actually get the performance going. And so I would sit in on story meetings with Stephen and David Kep and bring a bunch of dinosaur books. And in Crichton's book, the first creature you see is a brontosaurus. So I'm able to say, you know, there's a lot more, there's a dinosaur that's a lot bigger than the brontosaurus, and it looks a lot more interesting. And it's called a brachiosaurus, and I show him the picture of it, and Stephen goes, that's great, yeah, we'll use that. And then you get to the pages where there's a stampede, and what Crichton had in his book was duck-billed dinosaurs stampeding. And you know, I didn't feel that the duck-billed dinosaurs could really get up to 50 miles an hour. They would look kind of silly. They'd look like ducks and waddle. So I proposed a ostrich dinosaur called a Gallimimus, which was about, you know, 14 feet long, and showed them pictures of that. And you know, Stephen went, yeah, great. And so, yeah, I was able to help on that level, you know.
Well, I would talk with you for hours, but we don't have that much time. So I thank you very much. And thanks a lot to Phil Tippett for sharing your time with us as a guest of the View Festival in Torino and as a very world expert on special effects. So thank you very much for being with us. I am Angelo Cerbi for Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.